Hi, I'm Heather Mulder.
And I'm Janice Greeno, and you're listening to Dementia Untangled, where we explore the topic of dementia through conversations with physicians, experts, and community leaders.
Our discussions focus on innovative ideas, practical strategies, and proven methods to guide caregivers along a supportive path.
And welcome to Dementia Untangled. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of our podcast.
Today, our conversation is going to be with Alan Anderson, who is a geriatric psychiatrist and director of Banner Alzheimer's Institute in Tucson. And we're going to be discussing late day confusion, otherwise known as sundowning. And, you know, Janice, sundowning seems to occur more and more frequently, kind of as the disease progresses. And I find when I'm teaching classes, whether it be to caregivers or first responders, as soon as the word sundowning comes up, I get so many nods of recognition from people in attendance. So I'm really looking forward to untangling this today.
I've heard the very same response. You hear the sundowning word and people are nodding their head and you can see that frustration that they've felt right on their faces. It's definitely a common and very challenging behavior. And I am so very interested in Dr. Anderson's perspective on why sundowning happens, what it is, and ways that it can be managed.
Well, Dr. Anderson, welcome to Dementia Untangled. Thank you for joining us today.
Pleasure is mine. Thanks.
We always like to start off our discussions in a similar fashion and learn a little bit more about you. So could you share with us what was your journey and what led you to connect with the dementia community?
So I decided upon residency in psychiatry, but as I was doing my residency, I happened to be mentored by senior psychiatrists, faculty members who were geriatric psychiatrists. And to me, at that time in early in my career and training, it just felt like the right fit for me. I got out into a job that I had more of a general population of general adults and geriatrics, but gravitated more and more to geriatrics, and then even specifically in geriatric into the dementia realm of caring for, diagnosing and caring for patients with dementing illnesses. And it just became what seemed to fit me the best. So it's worked, and I've never looked back on the decision to selectively take on the work in dementia care.
What a great story, and we're so glad that you're able to join us to discuss this topic today. Let's start at the beginning, and can you tell us what specifically is sundowning?
So sundowning is actually what we would call a syndrome. A syndrome is a collection of signs and symptoms. And in this case, the signs and symptoms include some of the what we call neuropsychiatric symptoms or behavioral symptoms of dementia. And in sundowning in particular, what is observed is that these symptoms either come on in the late part of the day, early evening, or are symptoms that may be present in a mild form and then get exaggerated towards the end of the day. And sundowning includes typical symptoms of what a lot of family members have seen in their middle stage dementia patients, increased confusion, worsening disorientation. And they may recognize things well in the morning, but as the day gets on, they have more difficulty recognizing the environment and what's going on around them. They can become restless in pace. They can become resistant to any help. They can have mood changes where they could become depressed and tearful or irritable and hostile. And they have hallucinations, paranoid thinking, verbal agitation, such as yelling out or screaming. And then it could even escalate in some patients to physical aggression and potential injury to themselves or others.
So I'm wondering why it's named sundowning. I'm guessing because it typically comes on at sundown or at dusk, but does it always happen at sunset?
No, it doesn't always happen at sunset. In fact, in preparing for this, I thought, you know, it would be interesting to call up to the northern part of Alaska and find out what happens when the days are 24 hours there. But I suspect that they would still have some kind of syndrome like this. And I say it doesn't always happen exactly at sundown, but it is common around the time that the sun is setting for outside images to become a bit distorted because of the shadows of the sun setting. And this may be in many patients a trigger of misperceptions and fears that might then trigger paranoid thinking. So there may be some rationale that some of this is related to the sun going down and the outside shadows. On the other hand, you know, these are patients that get up in the morning and they have a dementia syndrome that has robbed them from their ability to really make sense of the world. And they may be working from the time they're out of bed till late in the day, trying to figure things out. And so it may be in part a fatigue that comes on with some of these patients in the later part of the day that adds to it, other than what I mentioned about the shadows and the sunlight.
And Dr. Anderson, I feel like I hear about this happening more when people are a little more progressed in their disease, more in the moderate stage. Is that the case? And how prevalent is it?
Yes, it is this state that it's very unusual to see this in the early stage of dementia. Typically, it's either moderate or beyond into a more severe stage. According to the Alzheimer's Association, they state in their information that about 20% of patients with Alzheimer's disease or other dementias may experience this. But, you know, it can be more common in certain environments. For example, it's often cited to be much more common in long-term care facilities. And there may be some reasons for that. Changes, shift happens late in the afternoon and things are more chaotic. Staff are less available to help comfort and give one-on-one interventions to patients. And so in some studies, it may occur up to 60% in long-term care residents with moderate or severe dementia.
You talk about long-term care facilities and some of the factors that may contribute to it there. In general, what are some things that cause or contribute to sundowning?
So what we think is probably one of the best hypotheses for what may lead to it is changes in what we call circadian rhythm. That's how our brains set our sleep-wake cycles. And we note that just with aging, that changes. But when you add to aging a disease like Alzheimer's, where parts of the brain degenerate, well, that degeneration also in the middle stage starts to affect more primitive functions and functions that include the functions, parts of the brain that control our sleep-wake cycle. So it actually causes some of these changes. And part of that may be also related to decreased melatonin and decrease in other neurotransmitters. So that's our best theory to date, that sleep disturbance due to altered rhythm disturbance may be at the crux of this. And so what we see is that the dementia patients often get poor sleep at night. They're more disrupted sleep. They have less efficient sleep. They may be up a lot. And then that leads to fatigue and distress that occurs later in the daytime.
That's so interesting. And, you know, when we talk about behavioral changes and dementia, we're always talking about how do you identify what is the trigger, what caused this behavior to happen? Do we look for the trigger in sundowning as well?
So that's a very important question and a very important point to make. Oftentimes, when we take the time to think about what may happen that brings on some of this, especially more significant agitated behavior, we want to think about what might be triggers. And in thinking about this talk, I actually tried to put together something that would be a simple way to remember some of this. I came up with the acronym PULSE, P-U-L-S-E. And I want to go through that. I picked the P first, especially because it seems to be a common unrecognized issue in middle and late stage dementia patients, and that is pain or physical distress. And other physical distress can include things like incontinence, constipation, hunger, or thirst. But I think unrecognized pain is very common. I'll give a case example of a patient who was moderately to severely demented and had a hard time communicating with staff, and she had a number of days where she was very agitated later in the day, spitting, yelling, refusing care. And they were asked for me to see her. And once I walked into the room, I noticed quickly there was an asymmetry to this woman. Her left shoulder was lower than her right shoulder. And I asked her if she was in pain and she said no, but I asked her if I could touch and move her arm lightly. And as soon as I did that, just a minimal amount, she shrieked in pain. What happened is she had a fractured humerus. So if we're not looking for some of these triggers, and pain is an important one, we're going to miss things. The U in PULSE stands for urinary tract infection, but you can also think about other infections that are common in this population, like aspiration pneumonia. We want to make sure we're on top of looking at infection as a trigger. The L in PULSE stands for lighting. Many, many facilities in the old style of facility have such poor indoor light, very little natural light, and it's helpful to keep things lighted, especially as the day gets to the end where outside lighting is diminished. S stands for sleep, but also caregiver stress. So sleep, we could talk about later, but that's an important thing to try to look at triggers of how they're sleeping and how much sleep they're maybe not getting and trying to remedy that, because that, again, that leads to fatigue and some of these behaviors are brought on by that. But then caregiver stress. And caregiver stress is in part based on the fact that caregivers haven't gone through the training that I have and that our staff have and other people that are dementia caregivers professionals have. And they don't always know what's right to say, what's wrong to say. And I'll give a case example of how this can really make a difference. I had an admission in our unit of a colleague. It was an emergency room physician who I had worked with for 10 years on the medical staff. While I wasn't socially friendly with him, I got to know him pretty well. And unfortunately, after retirement, he developed Alzheimer's disease and was on our unit. And one day he was sitting in the common area and appeared very upset. And I went over because he motioned me to come over and he looked very angry. I asked him to go to a side room and we sat down and I sat down facing him. And I said, you know, tell me what's going on, Bob. That wasn't his real name. He looked at me and he said, why are you sleeping with my wife? And it just took me so back at the moment. I had never expected something like that. And so the first thing I did was take a deep breath, something I tell all caregivers to do, because often the first thing you say may be the wrong thing. And instead of trying to push the reality I wanted to push at him, which was, Bob, I would never do that. I would never violate that. Instead of saying that, which is just what I wanted to say probably at first, I asked him how he felt about that. I said, you know, you must, you know, feel very angry about that. He said, I'm enraged. I said, Bob, I'm sorry you feel that way. But I acknowledged his feelings, validated his feelings, and immediately everything, all this tension went away. And immediately he thanked me and life went on and never again did it ever come up. And I say this because stressed caregivers often want to just have an immediate gut response. It's often a response that is reality-based and it sometimes has a backfiring effect. And it made me develop a mantra that when I would give talks to the lay groups that I developed, I call it Anderson's mantra. They don't get it. They won't get it. I can get it. We really have to stop trying to get our moderate and severe dementia patients to accept our reality. And we really have to try to understand where their reality is, understand their feelings about it, and go with that rather than pushing what is our reality onto them. The last thing I'll mention about this is environment. That's the E of PULSE. And it's important to maintain the best we can a calm and soothing environment, a lighted environment. And sometimes that's very important to do, especially in long-term care units. I added to PULSE a dash D because, and D stands for drugs, because there are some medications that we have to look at that might exacerbate these symptoms. It might even create these symptoms of agitated behaviors in our dementia patients.
Dr. Anderson, this is such a great acronym. I haven't heard this before, and thank you for developing this for us. When we're thinking about these triggers of what it might be, how do we identify which one it could be?
Yeah, and this leads to something that I was involved with in the institution I worked in Maryland. It wasn't something I came up with, I wish I had, but they had developed something which was a way to help them identify triggers and then create a plan to address those triggers. And it was later encapsulated in a journal article in JAGS, the year was 2014, by an author from Hopkins who worked at our unit and some others. And it was called DICE, D-I-C-E. And let me tell you about this, because I think it's a really cool way to have staff work on trying to identify triggers, or even, you know, family caregivers doing the same. So D in DICE stands for describe. We all were born with eyes and ears that help us take in what's going on in the environment. And we can describe what has happened and what was maybe the temperature of the home or environment before the behavior, what the behavior was. What was it? Yelling? Was it physical, verbal? What was it? And then what happened after the behavior? And that can be described in detail. When we have that description, we can then invoke the I of DICE, which is to investigate, to look at, well, okay, let's think of some reasons that this might have occurred, some hypothesis. And then if we get a good hypothesis, we can then create the C in DICE, create a program, a plan to address it. And then once we do that, we want to evaluate, was it successful? And by the way, if it's successful, we want to broadcast. We want to make sure that every caregiver knows that when this behavior came up, we noticed this triggers and we created this plan and it worked beautifully. And so we want to make sure that we do this. This is actually sort of what I would call a mini scientific method. And it's really cool because we could teach CNAs, certified nursing assistants in long-term care, to use this and to come up with really great ideas on their own. Because let's face it, the family caregiver and the professional caregivers, they're the ones that are spending the time with these patients. They're observing this behavior very closely. They can describe it well. They can take part in identifying what might be underlying it and then create a plan to address it. If I give a very simple example of that, I mean, this is just simple and medically based, is if there was a sudden change in behavior and part of that behavior included things like frequent urination, incontinence, and foul-smelling urine, well, then we would quickly form a hypothesis, okay, this could be a urine infection that's leading to this behavior. And then, of course, we would create the plan of starting the patient on an antibiotic to treat the urine infection. And hopefully, if it was the correct antibiotic by the culture designation, we would get a result of the behavior being resolved. And so this is just a medical example of how DICE could be used, but it could certainly be used in identifying environmental factors, caregiver factors. And, you know, sometimes it may be humbling because we may identify that exactly the trigger was the approach that the caregiver took with the patient that then escalated the patient's behaviors. But that's great because that the caregiver can learn, the team can learn, other family members can learn. This is what led to the behavior. And so that DICE acronym is a great way to identify triggers.
Well, I think that's a really helpful way of just kind of encapsulating how do we think through and try to identify what the cause of this behavior or what sundowning is. So describe, investigate, create, and then evaluate. So I think that's going to be really helpful in taking, sometimes behaviors can become emotionally charged situations, especially for family caregivers. And so this is a nice way to just kind of pull it back in, pause, and proceed logically. I think with behaviors too, we talk about a lot of how do we prevent behaviors from happening altogether. Could you share with us, are there some prevention strategies for sundowning or some non-pharmacological interventions that we could try?
So absolutely there are, and thanks for the question. So first of all, I think about the environment, but before that even, again, with the hypothesis that much of this may be explained by the altered circadian rhythm, I want folks to focus on sleep, trying to get good sleep habits, set to bedtime, set awaken time, follow good sleep hygiene, try to make the bedroom as comfortable as possible, bring noise level down, don't exercise at night, don't eat any heavy meals at night, of course, no alcohol for these patients, limit caffeine only to the morning if you want to use some caffeine like coffee, but just doing simple things to promote the best sleep. That could be a big preventive strategy. We can think about reducing stimulation in the environment. An example in a home would be, you know, I think about a group of individuals where they're taking care of a parent with dementia, but they have teenage kids in the home. And so that later part of the day could be a very chaotic time of day when you have a couple of teenagers coming down, doing their things like turning TVs on and music on and noise. And then you might have had a bad day at work and you're coming home not in the best of mood, and things could just snowball after that. So trying to do sensible things by reducing noise, reducing the chaos of day activities, and maybe having something like some soft music, good lighting, and maybe some things like good snacks and things to engage the patient with. Exercise is also a good preventive strategy. Exercise helps not only with sleep, but can help with some of these behaviors. You want to do exercise more in the earlier part or midday, not later in the day, and engage people in activities throughout the day. Soothing music, I mentioned, mindfulness and breathing techniques, and just trying to get people to relax. And that's really good for the caregiver. But take a deep breath whenever you're addressing some of these problems to prevent them from getting worse. Because again, I always tell caregivers, if you're going to speak from your gut and say the first thing that comes to mind, it may be in many cases the wrong thing. Take a deep breath or two, try to think about what's the next best thing to say. Lastly, there's some thoughts about things like aromatherapy and using aromas like chamomile and lavender, their calming scents, if that's something that you would wish to do.
Dr. Anderson, when you think about sundowning, we really like to dive into this on Dementia Untangled and kind of untease the medical side, find out what we can do. Are there ways to treat this without prescription medication?
Yes, there are indeed ways to do this. First of all, I've been a big proponent of considering a trial of non-pharmacologic strategies first. And one of those that can sometimes be helpful is bright light therapy. Bright light therapy was initially developed to treat seasonal affective disorder. You know, when the days got shorter in the late fall and winter, some patients got depressed. It's also used to treat circadian rhythm disturbances. People who go to bed too early and get up too early could be treated with light therapy. Light therapy has been studied in dementia patients and in some studies has shown to reduce these agitated behaviors that we call sundowning. In addition to that, we have some non-prescription treatments that include things like melatonin. I mentioned that melatonin decreases in the brains of Alzheimer's patients. And sometimes you can combine things like light therapy and melatonin. Again, there's some differences of opinion, but I think that sometimes a brief nap early after lunch, early afternoon can sometimes help. When I say brief, 30, 45 minutes, you don't want it to be so long that it further disrupts sleep at night. Maybe even it might be good for the caregiver to have a brief nap if they can squeeze it in, just to sort of refuel and spark up some energy in their brain. So there are ways that we should try to address it before we jump into medications.
And so you bring up the, I think, next logical question here. Of course, we want to try to manage this without any medications. But if we've gone through everything in our toolbox and we're still having difficulty managing sundowning, are there medications that can be used to manage it, or are there particular medicines that we should avoid?
Good question. I'd like to start first with the bad medications, whatever you consider medicines we want to avoid. And these tend to be the more sedating medications, and they include medicines in the class of benzodiazepines. This would include older medicines like Valium and newer medicines like Ativan and Xanax. And these may, in people's opinion, seem to be good because they can sedate the person. But let me tell you, they often have a different effect. They can often rev people up and get them more agitated. And this has actually been seen in plenty of studies where they've tried to use these medicines in these kind of conditions. And I want to have you think about this. If you were in with normal cognition, if you were in a locked place, a locked building, and there was a lot of strangers around that you didn't recognize and things that just seemed didn't go right, and someone came up and gave you a pill to swallow, and you were suddenly feeling drowsy from that, your natural tendency would be to fight that, you know, to fight that sedating feeling. And I think that's somewhat of what happens in these patients when we give them something that is sedating, when they have these distorted thoughts about being paranoid or what these hallucinations are about and what are all these strange people doing. And so we don't want to use these medicines. And other medicines that would be included in this might be some of the sedating medicines that are used for sleep, and even things that are over-the-counter, like the preparations that have sedating and the histamines, like Benadryl. So yeah, we want to avoid those. The other real reasons is they not only have that bad effect of having a paradoxical increase in behaviors, but they also increase risk of falls and they can worsen confusion. So if we do get to a point that we want to think about medication use, there may be some benefit for some medicines. And we've shown some increasing benefits in controlling some of these behavioral symptoms with more modern serotonin antidepressants. But one caveat about that, or one caution about that, these are not medicines that you give as needed. You wouldn't see someone being agitated and say, okay, you've never been on this medicine, but here's a Prozac to manage that. But these are medicines that if people had these repeated behaviors, might be started on a daily basis. Of course, they have side effects, but they're not as bad as the side effects of the big guns, which I'll get to in a minute. But before I get there, there's also some other things in addition to melatonin that might help with sleep that are prescription, like low doses of a sedative antidepressant called trazodone, and then low doses of an older antidepressant called doxepin. And when I say low doses, antidepressant doses are 100 to 200 milligrams. Doses for sleep are like 1 to 6 milligrams. So we can think of some ways to improve sleep through some prudent medication use, not traditional sleep medications, things like I mentioned just now. When I say big guns, the big guns, the nuclear weapons at getting at some of this are medicines we really try to avoid. These are the antipsychotic medications. Now, I will tell you that they have their purpose. And one of the purposes they have is they may be very useful when people are very psychotic, either delusional, paranoid, or severe threatening hallucinations, and as a result are either so in so much discomfort that they're ready to fight, hurt somebody, we may need to quickly get a medicine in there that not only will maybe have some sedation, but will target the psychosis, target the hallucinations, target the paranoid thinking. And this is especially true if we have a sense that this is leading to physical aggression, because if we don't have something that we might use in that urgent issue, we may be ending up in having to call police, restrain the patient, and have them go off to the emergency department and possibly a psychiatric hospitalization. So we might use those as a last resort. And I say last resort, we don't want to wait till they're actually physically aggressive, but if we can predict that we're heading that way, to get some of these medicines on board to help. But again, and especially I will say at BAI, Banner's Alzheimer's Institute, we are all in favor of looking at all of the non-medication approaches we can take first and saving these medications for when we truly need them, when these other things don't work.
Well, Dr. Anderson, I think this has been a really interesting conversation. I wonder if you could provide us with your final thought when it comes to late day confusion or sundowning.
Even though many of these patients end up at this stage of disease being treated with some of the treatments for Alzheimer's disease, like the medicines like Aricept, Dexilan, and Razadine, and Namenda or Memantine, sometimes they don't. And I will just say that sometimes it's prudent to think about adding those medicines because they do help the underlying disease and may help prevent behaviors. But in terms of final thoughts, one of my final thoughts is caregiver, take care of thyself. I see so many caregivers that put in all their time and effort throughout the day of caregiving for their family member that their reserves are zero. I mean, they overstress themselves. When they are stressed to that degree, they are never going to be able to do exactly the right thing because they're going to resort to some kind of quick response and probably say the wrong thing. And so caregivers really need to take some time for themselves. They need to engage in other activities. They need to find some respite by having another family member sub in and take care if someone needs one-on-one care all of the time. They may need, if they're this sandwich generation of a child taking care of a parent, they may need to hire someone to come in at night if there's no other way to benefit this Alzheimer's patient with their sleep-wake cycle disturbance and getting up all through the night, because there's no way they can physically and mentally do this job if they have to work all day, come home, and not get a good night's sleep. So caregivers do need to take care of themselves. Stressed caregivers will have a much harder time managing this problem.
Today, our conversation has been with Dr. Alan Anderson, geriatric psychiatrist and director of Banner Alzheimer's Institute Tucson. Dr. Anderson, thank you so much for your time and helping us untangle sundowning.
Thank you, and I hope that we continue this podcast because I think it's very helpful for the public, so thanks.
Thank you so much, Dr. Anderson. This has been incredible today. I especially have appreciated your acronyms. And hey, thank you, Heather, for another great conversation. And thank you to our wonderful listeners. We are so glad you joined us. Please, if you haven't already, subscribe to our podcast. And I'm looking forward to our next conversation.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Dementia Untangled. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dementia Untangled is hosted by Heather Mulder and Janice Greeno, produced and edited by Amber Ayers, and is brought to you by Banner Alzheimer's Institute and Banner Sun Health Research Institute. We are supported by generous donations to the Banner Alzheimer's Foundation.
Please visit our website at banneralz.org and follow us on Facebook to learn more about upcoming events. If you have questions or comments, please email us at dementiauntangled@bannerhealth.com.